Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. The border between Russia and China is one of the world's longest, spanning thousands of miles. It's one of the few extended land borders between two great powers, subject to decades of history, conflict, and cooperation. Yet for such an important division, there are surprisingly few crossings, with not one passenger bridge in operation. On the Edge, Life Along the Russia-China Border by Carolyn Humphrey and Frank Billet is an in-depth study of this border, looking at the divided island of Bolshoi-Ussuriski and the border towns of Blagoveshchensk and Heihe. On the Edge gives a picture of how people live, work, and trade along this little studied border. Frank Billet is program director at the Tang Center for Silk Road Studies, University of California, Berkeley. He is the author and editor of three books about East Asia, including Xenophobia, Anxiety, Violence, and the Making of Mongolian Identity. Caroline Humphrey is fellow of King's College at the University of Cambridge and founder of the university's Mongolia and Inner Asia Studies Unit. She is the author of several books about the anthropology of Inner Asia and recently edited and contributed to Trust and Mistrust in the Economies of the China-Russia Borderlands. We're joined again today by Yvonne Lau. Yvonne, say about yourself, share a few words about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nicholas, for having me again. I'm Fortune Magazine's Asia Markets reporter based in Hong Kong. I cover everything from IPOs, cryptocurrency, and China. My first experience of the Russian Far East was back in 2017 in Vladivostok, a Russian port city about 4 hours away by plane from Hong Kong. In the following years, I began sojourning across Siberia, specifically along the border towns close to China. I then became interested in Russia and China's long history of complex ties and have been tracking developments along the Sino-Russia border since. I should note that Carolyn and Frank's research was an invaluable companion during these trips, so I'm very excited for a conversation today and to hear what they have to say.
So in this interview, we'll talk about, well, the border and the people that live on either side of it. So, Carolyn and Frank, thank you so much for joining me and Yvonne today. Perhaps it's best to start with the border. Essentially, how long is it? What's the history behind it? And kind of what's that border like from a geographical standpoint?
Well, thank you, Nicholas, for having us on your show. The border is 2,600 miles long, which is 4,100 kilometers. And it runs from the eastern tip of Mongolia all the way along, going eastwards until it meets the Sea of Japan at Vladivostok and further south than that. Now, all of this border, practically all of it, is great rivers. And these are unlike any rivers you find in Europe, let's say. They're great twisting things that curl round in coils. They flood very often. They've got dozens, in fact, hundreds of little islands in the middle of them, and they keep changing their course. So they're a very difficult border to manage and to sort of plot out, as you can see. And there are very few places where there's an actual land border between Russia and China. There's one at the far western end of this border, and there's another one in the far east. But most of it is these great rivers. Now, the history of the border is a very old one. It goes back to the 17th century and was fixed by treaties between Tsarist Russia and the Qing Empire of China. And those treaties lasted until about 1860, when the Russians took advantage of weakness in China at the time and forced the Chinese emperor into giving up a large chunk of land, a really huge territory in the Far East. And this was, of course, one of the so-called unequal treaties that China signed in that period. And the Russians then built the city of Vladivostok on that land. And Vladivostok, by the way, the word in Russian means rule the East. So it's a very clear sort of indication of the meaning of this area for Russia. Now, today, there's no plan in China to take back that land from Russia, unlike, say, the way that China took back Hong Kong from Britain. But we did find on the ground that the Chinese people have not really forgotten that whole episode. And there is a bit of sort of potential resentment brewing inside China about the land that was taken away from them.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps we could talk about the first case study in the book, the island of Bolshoi Ussuriski. I found this chapter very interesting. I recall reading in this chapter that there's a statue of the Chinese character Dong on the Chinese side of the island, which from, I believe it's a bird's eye perspective, it resembles a warship pointed at Khabarovsk. I remember when I was in Khabarovsk and I was walking along the embankment and there was a cannon pointing towards the Chinese side. It seems like the landmarks here are loaded with symbolic meaning. So perhaps you could explain, you know, why is this island important in the history of Sino-Russian relations? What made this island contested and how was the conflict resolved?
Yes, this is a really fascinating island. What happened here was that both sides, both Russia and China, initially, they're big national states. They wanted to get as much sovereignty as they could in this region. And they both thought that the their land, their sovereignty extended to the other side of the river. So they both claimed these islands in the river for many, many years. And there were many disputes about this. And indeed, there was a war fought between China and Russia in the 1960s. But in more recent years, sort of around 2000 and afterwards, they began to realize they really needed to settle this border issue all the way along and decide to whom the islands in the middle of the river actually belonged. And they decided to go by the internationally recognized way of dealing this, which is to run the border along the deepest channel of the river, the Thalweg. And they did this, and the result with Bolshoi Ussuriski was that it should belong to China because the deepest channel goes north of it on the Chinese side. But the Russians were worried about having a buffer between China and Khabarovsk. As it's good you notice that gun facing from Khabarovsk towards China. And so it was decided to cut the island in half, and the Russians would keep one half of it as a kind of buffer for Khabarovsk, and the Chinese would have the other side. And we found the island so interesting because what happened there, when you have the same place but each side belonging to the other country, is very indicative of the two countries as a whole, we think. And what happened on the Chinese side was that they decided to integrate the island into their ecology and development policy for the north of China. And they turned the island into a sort of ecological zone, but a money-making one, so that they made it into a sort of ecological tourism base. And thousands of tourists went onto the Chinese side, and they built up sort of a bridge and things like bird watching platforms and that kind of thing where people could, a tourist could go. On the Russian side, there had been an army base that fell into disrepair. And on the Russian side, more or less nothing has happened for years and years and years. So it's full of ruins and very few people living there, although there've been a tremendous number of rather idealistic plans of what they might do with the island, and nothing has actually happened. And as Yvonne said, both sides, however, see it as a very symbolic space. And the Chinese have placed this huge monument, the letter Dong, and a very elaborate pagoda with wonderful carvings and evidence of Chinese culture on their side. On the Russian side, they've built nothing practically except for a tiny little Russian Orthodox chapel. And there really isn't much congregation or anything like that. There's no priest. And they occasionally hold some religious services for military personnel at that chapel, but basically it stands there alone, and it's dedicated, in fact, to a saint of the lone warrior, the idea of this lone person standing up for Christianity and Russia on the border of China.
Mm-hmm. This case study is fascinating, and it's not the only contested island in the history of Sino-Russian ties. It brings to mind Damansky Island, which was eventually ceded to China. And, you know, I suppose after this contested island, the conflict here was resolved. Sino-Russian ties began improving, and cross-border trade finally opened up in the late 1980s. So I would like to ask you both, how did business links in this border region develop? Was there trade during China and Russia's early ties, say, in the 17th century, or did it primarily develop after the fall of the Soviet Union? And how did both sides perceive these links, and have these perceptions changed today?
Well, I think there has been trade all along between China and Russia. Used to be highly sort of part of diplomacy between the two countries. So there would be trade caravans, let's say, in the 18th century going from Russia to China to take back goods. And in the 19th century, there developed a great tea trade, which crossed Mongolia, in fact, and so bypassed a bit of this border. But that was a very, very strong trade until it was overtaken by sea maritime trade in tea and fell sort of, it kind of ended really by the end of the 19th century. And so now what we have is a huge border trade of manufactured goods, mainly from China. That's clothing, utensils, computers, mobile phones, practically anything you can name that's manufactured is made in China and sold in Russia. And what happens is that people from Russia, so-called shuttle traders, they're mostly sort of not professional traders. They're people who just go over there, buy up stuff, work for little companies, and then go back to Russia carrying it themselves and selling it off in local shops or in local markets. And that's usually a sort of rather low-level trade. It's not high value. And of course, as everybody knows, the high-value trade between China and Russia is in gas and oil and minerals, coal, timber, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And for all of this trade, for a border between two major countries, it seems like there are surprisingly few infrastructure links. In the book, it mentions that, you know, China has this longstanding policy to develop via investment in transport infrastructure, while in Russia, there are no roads that are by the border, and these villages have to make do with dirt roads, essentially. I remember reading about one bridge, the Amur River Bridge, which was announced when Yeltsin was still in power, and I believe it recently opened last year. So why is it that, you know, there's such significant cross-border trade happening in these regions, but yet the infrastructure ties still lack here?
I think it's mainly because Russia is very much obsessed with security along this border. In fact, along the entire Russia border, not just the one with China, but all Russian borders, they have a so-called security zone, which is several kilometers deep. It runs like a ribbon all the way along the border. And this means that nobody can go into this zone without permission, even if they live there, even if they're a Russian citizen. And for foreigners, it's difficult to go into those zones. You have to get special permission. That's one thing that's held up kind of general development along the border. So there's this kind of somewhat blank space running along the border. And I think this is to do with the fact that the whole region of the Russian Far East was very militarized. It was full of army bases and factories producing military equipment, nuclear equipment, mining of uranium, and a large number of very high security sort of production installations were sort of along this border. Another thing, I guess, was that many of these places were closed themselves because they were highly sensitive from the information point of view. In the past, they were associated with unfree labor, with gulag camps, and so on. So a lot of the labor came from that source, which was another reason to keep them out of the public eye. So that sort of general buildup of security, a whole range of security issues, I think, on the Russian side, it's not exactly the same now as it used to be, of course, but because there's considerably less in terms of the military installations than there used to be. But even so, they're still very security conscious, and I think they're worried that if they opened up to too many avenues into China, backwards and forwards, that the ordinary population could come and go more or less as they wanted, that would be a very dangerous security situation from their point of view. They would feel they'd be losing control. And so there have been elements in Russia, mainly the security services, which have tried to prevent this happening. And I think that's been the cases with things like the bridges over the river, which have been held up mainly on the Russian side.
Yeah, and I think this anxiety is also linked to the demographic imbalance between the two. But I think the question you pose, Ivan, is the lack of infrastructure that we see maybe at regional level is not, I mean, that's, if you look at national level, that's different, because Manchuria is actually one of the main land ports, and there's a lot of traffic going through it. So between the two countries, there is actually a lot of exchange, and the infrastructure is there. But it's just at regional level, all along the border, there isn't that much. But you have to also bear in mind there's only 5 million people live on the Russian side, living in the entire Russian Far East. So the exchange that we have between the Russians living in the Russian Far East and the Chinese on the other side is not at the same level, of course, in terms of size. So I think there's a difference there, but if you talk about the national or the regional engagement and the connections.
Well, it's interesting you talk about size and the difference in size, because I think that's a good segue into your second case study, which are the cities of Blagoveshchensk and Heihe. Blagoveshchensk is obviously, you know, on the Russian side. I think it's the population of kind of 200,000-300,000. And then you have Heihe on the other side, which has grown from what was a tiny village to quite a large city. I guess kind of, again, to help set the scene, what are these two cities and what are their histories?
Right. So these two cities were very interesting to me personally when we started the project, because they are really the only two cities of comparable size today, just by the border. I mean, there are cities, of course, on either side, but Vladivostok is not right there on the border. Khabarovsk is, but there isn't an exact, you know, a city of similar size right on the other side. Whereas Blagoveshchensk and Heihe are really, they're just separated by a river. And from certain viewpoints, it even looks like a single place. They're really kind of two cities just next to each other for 500 meters apart. So it was very interesting to then look at the way they have grown, the way they have developed, and the way they really kind of an example of each country to the other side. So Blagoveshchensk is not just a city, it's also the face of Russia, and same thing for Heihe, it's been the face of China for a lot of Russians. It was, as I said, a similar size. They're actually difficult to compare because the way cities are defined are different in Russia and China. In China, they tend to include a lot of, they tend to be larger areas encompassing some what we would see as non-urban space. But they are still kind of a similar size and similar population. As you said, Jeje was just a tiny little settlement until the late 80s. And then when the border opened and people started trading, and developed very quickly. And the way the reason it developed so quickly is because Russians were right on the other side. They needed a lot of, various consumer goods that China was producing, and they were then lacking in Russia. So it was a perfect moment for cities like Jeje, but also Manzhouli and other cities on the border on the Chinese side to develop and develop very quickly. So Blagoveshchensk was established as a modern city in 1856. There were various settlements before that in the area, forts, etc. But the city was established in 1856. And Jeje was there as well. I mean, it was, you know, there were like a bunch of settlements on either side. At first sight, these two cities are very different. Jeje is, there's a lot of lights, especially in the evening and at night. All the buildings are illuminated, whereas on the Russian side, that's not the case. Jeje is vertical. There's really kind of this emphasis on high rise, whereas the way urban modernity is mobilized in Russia is very different. It tends to be more focused on large avenues with greenery on a grid, on a very fixed grid. And Jeje is more dense, therefore, than Blagoveshchensk. So they look very, very different. If you're in Jeje and if you didn't know where you were, you'd imagine you could be anywhere in China, except for a few things I'll mention afterwards. And same thing for Russia. If you didn't know where you were, you could be anywhere in Russia. It could be in Eastern Europe. It's very different because they developed largely independently. I mean, Blagoveshchensk was established when there was really nothing on the other side. So it was kind of a way for Russia to mark its territory, like in the similar way as Blagoveshchensk, as Vladivostok, which is ruler of the East. Blagoveshchensk is the it's good news. It's basically kind of religious symbolism. So it was really kind of a way for Russia to mark its space there, and then Jeje developed very quickly on more Chinese model. But there are elements in Jeje that are interesting and really kind of, you can see where you are. I mean, it kind of betrays its location on the Russian border, because there's various urban furniture that is kind of Russian, with the Russian imaginary. You have like a Matryoshka dolls on the embankment. You have bears, which symbolize Russia. So all these things are a way, on the one hand, to, at least that's what Russians on the other side would say, it's a way to attract Russians, to make them feel at home. On the other hand, it's also a way to market itself as a unique place in China that could attract domestic tourists, a way where you can experience Russia without having to cross the border. On the Blagoveshchensk side, very similar to Khabarovsk, the monuments that you have on the embankment are all military, all about the military history. You have a tank, you have also, you know, facing China. You have a statue of a border guard with a dog. All the symbolism you have is very different there. There's no sense of engagement or trying to replicate China or make you feel China comfortable. It's the other way. It's really kind of marking again this spot, saying this is Russia, and it's always been Russia. So that is very different. But what we found very interesting is the more time you spend there, and the more you realize there is actually some bleed through of certain cultural elements, because the two cities are so close to each other and because they are so far from their respective center. There is also a need for them to engage visually and also in terms of what modernity might mean. So certain things that were actually criticized by Russians early on, like all these lights on buildings, which they thought were, you know, tacky and not really reflective of what urban modernity is, because it was so different from what they had, is something that's been adopted in Russia as well now. Some of the urban furniture, like trash cans, in Russia, in Blagoveshchensk, have been imported from Kherson, so they are the same as the Chinese side. It's with even the letters on them, you know, the instructions of where to dump the trash and where to dump the recycling. That's all in Chinese because of the material and economic engagement between the two, because they're so close to each other, so they have to trade with each other. So there is this kind of undercurrent of similarities, which is really interesting, and it's not something that is obvious at first sight.
Mm-hmm. I agree with your sentiment, Frank, that Heihe and Blagoveshchensk are really fascinating places, and particularly the fact that you can cross to the other side in about, you know, 10 to 15 minutes, pre-pandemic anyway. These two border towns aren't the only ones where, you know, cross-border trade and social interactions are happening daily. You mentioned Manzhouli and its sister city, Krasnokamensk, Puyuan, and Khabarovsk. So I'd like to ask you, what do people in these towns think about their counterparts across the river? The book talks about some long-held stereotypes by Chinese and Russians about their neighbors.
Right. Well, I think when the border reopened in the late 80s, there were very little direct knowledge of the other side. Everything had been kind of filtered through, propaganda on both sides. There was a lot of hostility. It was, of course, different for the older generation, for people who had lived, you know, would spend maybe time, you know, a few decades prior to that, when there was some engagement between the two countries. But generally, there was really not a lot of knowledge. So even people in Blagoveshchensk, I'll mention Blagoveshchensk quite a lot because that's been my primary focus on that border. But it would be true of other Russian cities. They really didn't know anything about the other side. So they were very curious to see. There was a lot of interest at first. But then there was also, because when Kherson started developing, it was first a village and then an overgrown village. And it was really not exactly a modern city in any kind of way. It was a lot of... The goods that were produced there were very often very shoddy, and you know, it was people just trying to make a living on the Chinese side and on the Russian side, trying to go there and buy those things. So there was this sense that China was actually very poor, very undeveloped, and it's been a reason why people have, you know, on the Russian side have criticized Kherson as not really modern, but just really kind of pretending. It was just a lot of lights, but really nothing behind it. There's still this sense for a lot of people in Russia that this is not real modernity. That's just kind of a fake. It's changing, especially as people are going further inland. They are confronted with, you know, the real modern cities of, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, and etc. And then so they see that it's actually something real. It's not just an illusion. But at the beginning, there was a lot of that sense of illusion. On the Chinese side, I think there was a lot of pragmatic attitudes. So there's a great opportunity to make money, to do business. People were learning at least, you know, rudimentary Russian in order to trade. Even though there's been this kind of a strong commercial engagement, there hasn't the social on the social level, it hasn't really followed, and not culturally either. In Blagoveshchensk, you never hear, for instance, Chinese music, or, you know, that if you see the films shown in cinema, they're either Russian or Western. There's not a lot of engagement at that level. In Kherson, it seems also, well, you know, we live next to Russia, we might as well make money out of it. But I also don't feel there's so much desire to really engage culturally. The Russians have been also, I mean, Russians in Kheykha, who go there for business, I mean, to buy things, they tend to be quite dismissive of the Chinese living there, and speaking to them is very often, you know, they use kind of the informal pronouns for you, you know, like tea, like in French too, with something they would never do, for instance, if they were, you know, in Western Europe, they would be much more polite. So there's this sense of a little bit of kind of a remnant, I would say, of the socialist times, where Russia was seen as leading the way and China was like the younger brother. So the fact that these roles have been reversed is not something people are really willing to really take seriously on the Russia side. I could say more, but maybe that answers the question that you had.
Mm-hmm. Frank Carolyn, I'd like to pivot a little bit to chapter four now, an important chapter in the book, as it discusses the oft-forgotten indigenous groups of the region, such as the Buryats and the Evenki. Could you briefly touch upon the history of the indigenous groups in this region along the Sino-Russian border towns and what their future looks like under modern Chinese and Russian rule?
Yes. The indigenous peoples are, they kind of divide into two kinds. Some of them are quite large in number, sort of hundreds of thousands of people, and they mainly have sort of Mongolian language ancestry of various kinds. And then there are a number of small groups, really with, you know, very few thousands of people, and very scattered, and sort of engaged in traditionally in things like hunting and fishing and reindeer herding, which don't have much of a future in the present day. And so the indigenous peoples, it's difficult to think of them all as one kind of set of problems, and they've reacted very differently to the border, I think. Broadly speaking, I think we can say that the small groups are trying to survive on either side of the border in the best way they can, and they're not terribly interested in making contact with one another over the border. So even though they may actually ethnically be the same group, they hardly recognize that, or if they do, they don't have very much interest in contacting the other side. So you don't get, let's say, somebody or some people from one of the small groups in Russia wanting to go to China or the other way around to visit, let's say, to visit long-distant relatives. That's completely different with the larger group, these the ones with a Mongolian background. They're, on the contrary, very, very interested. And this has been growing in recent years. And they've elaborated ways of thinking about the links with one another, which are very historical. So they will look back in their history and say, yes, we had these common ancestors. And this will go back many centuries. And they try to concoct in their mind and their imagination a vision of themselves as a people which didn't take account of this border at all. And so these would be conglomerations of people that spread across Asia, and classically they were nomadic people in the past. And so it's those kind of, what could you call it, almost imaginary groups that they're interested in getting together. And they do this in various ways. They have festivals and religious points where they go for migrations and rituals that they hold together. And it's really quite active, these people trying to get together at great length, you know, in terms of distance of miles and kilometers they have to travel to meet each other. It can be thousands of kilometers, and it's expensive and difficult getting across the border, and even the means of travel, because they go to obscure places that are religiously sacred places, but they're not at all easy to get to, and there may not be proper roads going there, that kind of thing. But they do pursue this, and I think it's an interesting phenomenon, because it runs against the idea of this kind of black and white. You've got Russia on one side, China on the other. Here are people trying to think about things in a different way and do their own thing, think about their own kind of communities that they're trying to bring together. And we document this in the book, and we show how difficult it is and how it doesn't always work out well, that, you know, you can get misunderstandings, which we document, but also a lot of enjoyment about from these things that people do together. I should say that the attitude of the governments in the countries is very different for this kind of phenomenon. In Mongolia, I think, which is sort of at the western end, comes between China and Russia, it's quite encouraged, really. I think there's nothing anybody has against it. China actually forbids these kind of festivities and meetings in its own territory unless they're organized by the government, the Chinese officials themselves, which is a slightly different thing. Very different, because it's not coming from the people themselves, but it's sort of organized from on top. And in Russia, they also try, from a government point of view, to kind of dominate these meetings in ways by sending along officials and politicians and other sort of high up people to try and make the whole thing more official and ceremonial, but they don't always succeed. And these kind of politics with regard to indigenous spontaneous indigenous meetings, I think indicates the views in both China and Russia, which for decades really has been to discourage indigenous people and not really help them in any way with their education or culture or language. I mean, all of those are under threat in both countries. And in both China and Russia, it's the spontaneity of indigenous activities that the government really doesn't like. And so there have been many cases of activists being punished or shut down or forced to go into exile, particularly, in Russia and in China, both places.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn Frank, much of your research along the Russia-China border was conducted in the decade prior, if I'm not mistaken. As we welcome 2022, the third year of the pandemic, the crossings between these border towns remain closed for ordinary people. I'd like to ask, what does this border closure mean for economic and social interactions in the region? And what does it mean for your research, given the difficulties of traveling to this region now?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. I don't know. I don't know what you think, Caroline, about this. I feel that they're just, you know, in a very similar situation to the rest of the world. I don't know whether there's anything unique to that border in terms of pandemic. I mean, maybe given that China has been very very careful to keep the numbers to zero, which is not the same case as Russia. So I don't know. It might, early on when the pandemic started, I think there was a lot of recognition on the part of Russia of what China was doing, that how responsive they were being. But as the things evolve, it's very difficult to know. I mean, it's so difficult to try and predict, you know, how things are going to impact, whether we're seeing the tail end of it and things are going to be normalized, or whether, you know, we'll be thinking of this, you know, in the future as the, oh, the 30th of the big pandemic, you know, who knows when that's going to stop. I don't know, Caroline, whether you've thought about that as well.
Well, I have heard from the Chinese colleagues that there is a sort of persistent sort of tendency in China to blame Russia for outbreaks of COVID along the border, that whenever people do somehow manage to cross, although I think the border is now completely closed, they then say, oh, there's one case in wherever it is, Hailar or somewhere like some city near the border. This is because it's come in from Russia. And they also blame the import of things like frozen fish and things like this from Russia. This is bringing in the virus. And so it's getting a fairly sort of xenophobic atmosphere in China, I think. But who knows how long that will last. It may die away quite quickly. I think the Russians, though, are worried by this. And I have seen from experts in Moscow calls somehow to regularize this situation with China, because they feel that this complete closure of the border is very difficult to sustain. And as Frank said, the fact that in Russia a lot more is allowed, whereas in China, as we know, you know, a couple of cases in one town and the whole city may be closed down. So the difference in attitude to the virus, I think, is beginning to tell and create some sort of strain on relations.
Mm. And in a way, I think this in terms of the pandemic, the attitudes of Russia and China are reversed, you know, because what we describe in the book is China being much more willing to engage with the other side, whereas Russia is more worried and trying to close the borders. And this is, in terms of the pandemic, it's been the opposite. It's China's been very, very careful closing its border, whereas in Russia there's been maybe less, you know, there's been some reluctance to block everything, and, you know, there's been a lot of cases and people refusing to get vaccinated, and, you know, so, yeah, it's interesting. You ask, and in terms of our research, well, now China is close to us. I am not particularly interested in going to Russia right now, given the level of the pandemic. But even before, when we're doing research at the border, because we needed visa for both countries, you know, it's like we couldn't really go back and forth all the time. I mean, what I would normally fly to China and have a double entry visa for China and then one single entry for Russia. And I do research in China, then in some in Russia, and then go back to China and then fly out. It was not possible to go back and forth. In that sense, COVID is probably not going to have a strong impact if we do research at the border. It would maybe just go on one side at a time.
I want to look a bit further into the future for this last question in our interview, which is, I mean, obviously, China and Russia have followed very different economic trajectories over the past few decades. China's seen tremendous economic growth. Russia it's been more complicated, but generally has had a much tougher time economically. And, you know, you read books about the Russian Far East. Russia is constantly concerned about China just sweeping and just taking it over. If not officially, then let's say unofficially, with a wave of Chinese migrants. They've been worried about this for centuries. You see strains of this in conversation today, but Russia, you even hinted at it in the answer you gave just now. Whereas it used to be Russia that was more concerned about keeping the border closed, and China being much more wanting to open the borders and do stuff in Russia. But kind of how do you see this divergence continuing to develop into the future? We can probably expect China will continue to grow. We can probably expect that Russia will continue to have these struggles economically. How do you think this divergence over time will be reflected along the border?
So we in our book, we try to Well, we're kind of careful about long-term predictions because, especially the way the world is now, it's like it's, you know, where you don't know what's happening.
Especially after the past 3 years, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I would be hard put to give any prediction about what's happening in the country we are living. So, you know, when you start, you know, looking at Russia and China, but I think you're right that the economic, you know, power of China is going to continue. It's going to improve. It's going to, you know, China is just going to get stronger. I doubt. I mean, it's impossible to know, but I feel that the Russian fear of China, Chinese moving in and physically, you know, people, the Russian Pharisees, is an unlikely scenario. But we could imagine Russia just becoming some kind of resource appendage and just being kind of in the suburbs of economic China in that sense. But we also have to keep in mind that Russia is not really prepared to do that. There's also a disconnect between the actual place of the country in the world and the way it imagines itself to be. So I don't think Russia is willing to become second fiddle. You know, it's not something that it would have to reimagine itself, and it still sees itself as a world power. So it's hard to know how things are going to go. I think It looks like Russia will have less and less of a role, but being pushed, if it's pushed too strongly, I don't know how it might react. Yeah,
I think if I could add to that, I think I would agree with everything Frank has said, but in the very long term, I think if we think about things like climate change. Things are moving gradually. It's apparent that greater and greater areas of Russia are, in a sense, benefiting from higher temperatures. Much more of the Russian Far East is now open for exploitation in agriculture and other ways. And here we see that whatever Moscow thinks, on the ground, local people are opening themselves up in Russia to Chinese farming in these areas. So for example, soya bean farming, there are huge acreages in Russia now that have that are under Chinese management or ownership, and they're exporting to China. And I think that in view of the long-term ways that populations react to these changes. I have read, I think we noted in the book somewhere, that there are predictions that there might be a move of population into those areas from China, just because when you have a country which is, parts of which, like China, will be going drier and less available for agriculture, and then you have nearby another area that's opening up and there are very, very few people living there, it's kind of inevitable. It's very difficult to stop that gradual move of population into those areas to take advantage of it. And there are sort of signs that that may be happening with, for example, this big company agribusiness, soya farming and that kind of thing. And I think Frank is right that Russians are aware in a way of this, and they don't want to encourage it necessarily. But then if local governments, municipalities, small towns want to benefit from agricultural development and other kinds of development on the spot, they may sort of let this happen willy-nilly. And so I agree it's very difficult to predict, but I wouldn't altogether rule out a gradual sort of move of Chinese population into the far east of Russia.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Caroline. And I think you're making a really a point that's actually core to what we've been doing with the book. I mean, when we started this project, which then turned into a book, we wanted to look at the border because we wanted to see what might be the incipient changes that were not yet registering at national level. So in the way the Russians and Chinese were engaged, what that could tell us about how the countries were moving. But I think we can also look, I mean, we could also reverse that and say that there's been this great announcement at national level, you know, that, oh, there's this Russian pivot to the east, but things don't move at the same speed at regional level. So there's really kind of these two different discourses. One is, you know, the macro, and one is the local. Anxieties that Russia might have about Chinese taking over might not necessarily be reflected in the same way or at all at local level, where people might, you know, and encourage and welcome Chinese economic engagement to revitalize the region. So it's, I think that what the book is really kind of one of the core hinges, I would say, of the book is this kind of two different discourses and how they come together, but they also remain separate on some level.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to the interview with Caroline Humphrey and Frank Billet, authors of On the Edge, Life Along the Russia-China Border. So Caroline, Frank, I actually do have one more question, which is, where can people find your work and what's next for you?
Right. So in terms of work, you mean the book or the work generally?
However you wish to interpret that question.
Okay. Well, the book is available on the website of Harvard University Press, as well as on Amazon and bookstores. I think a good way for people to track the work of academics in terms of not just books, but also articles, is to look at Academia.edu, maybe, where we just announced, you know, like recent publications. In terms of my own work, I am finalizing a monograph looking at borders more generally, looking at how borders are often described in corporeal language, you know, loss of territories kind of equated to mutilation or dismemberment. So I'm trying to grapple with this and try and see to what extent it can illuminate some of the nationalist move that we're seeing in various countries around the world.
And I've been writing an article on free speech in Russia, or what kind of language changes there have been in which if free speech is not possible, people do nevertheless manage to say what they think in various ways inside Russia.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can follow Yvonne Lau on Twitter at Yvonne Lau. That's YVONNEYLAU. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews, plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The ARB podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends if you want to continue to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Catherine Chan, author of The Macanese Diaspora in British Hong Kong, A Century of Trans-Imperial Drifting. But before then, Carolyn, Frank, thank you so much for joining me and Yvonne today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Thank you, Nicholas and Yvonne.
Thank you. Thank you to both of you.